还有康健的同仁呀，啊，我那做南京的。
So as we usually refer to as the three Manjushri, Longchenpa, Sakya Pandita, and Master Tsongkhapa are referred to as the three Manjushri, emanations of Manjushri. So, Master Tsongkhapa is a well-renowned master, a scholar adept, after moving to the central Tibet, then at that time, in Sangpu and Nyetang, Dewachen, where there were these great monastic institutions, he studied the Dharma and became a great scholar himself, and at age 25, he wrote the garland of a golden rosary and a commentary of Abhisamaya Alamkara. And this actually Taksang Lotsawa found, a Sakya master found, to be a really amazing writing of Master Tsongkhapa. So even at a young age, he became a very learned and a great scholar, and he was also was a great honest person, because when he wrote his later text, he said that he has written in his later writings that I have said such and such thing in the past in some of my other writings, and then he actually clarified his own position later on. And at the behest of Manjushri, he actually left the monasteries and lived as a hermit together with his eight chief disciples, Dodon Jambi Gyatso and so forth, and meditated in solitude in remote places. And then he actually found the profound view of emptiness and completed his analysis into the nature of reality, as he says, in the three principal aspects of the path. So, having studied the text and then meditated and reflected on them, as well as making offerings and prayers to fervent prayers to his deity, master deity, and after having done all these, when he actually was able to confirm to himself and was able to decisively find the correct view of emptiness, then he wrote the praise to the Buddha for teaching relativity. And then he also, from the tantric point of view, he realized the isolation of mind, and as we say in the prayer, the treasury of compassion and Manjushri, the treasury of wisdom and so forth. He was actually praised as being the embodiment of Manjushri, and being the embodiment of Avalokiteshvara Manjushri, which actually this prayer initially was written by Master Tsongkhapa himself as a praise to his master Rendawa, Shunulotu. But then Rendawa actually gave it back to him, changing his name to Master Tsongkhapa's name, Losang Thakpa, and calling him the scholar, crowning jewel of the scholars of the land of snows. And so this prayer is a very blessed one, and Jerem Boche. So I saw in Minyakun Sunsang Sernam's writing where he says that Rendawa was a great scholar who took great interest in Madhyamaka philosophy. Until that time, perhaps it may be the case that there was not so much interest in middle way. And so this Nyingma master has written that at the time of Rendawa, there was even the saying that even when moving, and people think about middle way, and while sitting also they think about middle way. And so wherever they are, they only think about middle way. So Master Tsongkhapa was a disciple of Rendawa, and it's not only the case that we should say that he was a great scholar and having the visions of dating and so forth, but if you look at the 18 volumes of his writings, you can actually infer from them that he was in fact an excellently great scholar. And if you in fact look into the tantric texts like the five commentary on the five stages and so forth, you can see he was writing from his own experience. And so we also have to keep our faith in the Master Tsongkhapa and say our prayers. The main prayer is Jamyang Chöje Deshi Baldin's secret biography of and so and so Jamyang Chöje Deshi Baldin says these lines at the end of this secret biography of Master Tsongkhapa. May the innate wisdom of great bliss reign throughout the world. May the stains of erroneous, page 18, may the stains of erroneously grasping mind and its objects be uprooted, and may all the inspired be inspired quickly to become like you, O Jetun Nama. And so forth. So we have a notion that everything will be actually gifted to us by the deities. Although the Buddha himself has said that he does not rinse or wash away the sins of sentient beings and so forth. But some of us are quite strange. We think that the blessings will come from the lamas, and spiritual feats will come from the deities, tutelary deities, meditation deities, and then enlightened activities will come from the dakas and dakinis and so forth. And then we don't actually do anything from by ourselves, but only think that these blessings and so forth will come from the masters, gurus, yidams and deities and so forth, and actually become rather complacent in our practice. So it's almost like we are doing things as if we actually believe in a creator God. So this is totally wrong. As the Buddha says, you are the master of yourself. So you have to actually achieve these attainments by through your own effort. And so as this prayer says, we should actually apply this within ourselves. May the wisdom of learning, contemplation, meditation overtake the earth. May the art of liberation, debate and composition flourish. So through this, one's study and practice, one should actually develop the great bliss, wisdom within ourselves. As the prayer also says, may the innate wisdom of great bliss reign throughout the world. And so, accordingly, you should see that you should actually put effort in studying and practicing the Dharma. And having done that yourself, having put your own effort and practiced the Dharma, then as a condition, external condition for your practice to go successfully, then you should pray to the Lamas, Siddhams, and so forth. So otherwise, if you go to the Christian monasteries, you'll see how simple life they live. The Christian monks live a very humble and simple life, and also the Hindus practitioners do the same. And so, in practicing the Dharma, we have to use our intelligence and then make transformation within ourselves, what we aspire. Therefore, we have to develop the understanding or insight into emptiness. Sarchin Losel Gyatso, in his prayer to the Vajrayogini, says, so this fatigued child takes rest in the forest. So we are like the someone who is tormented by the suffering. Feels fatigue through our reification of things, and therefore we are rather living a very tired life in samsara. And so why this happens is because of ignorance, which sees or misconception of reality, which has to be overcome by developing the wisdom, which sees the reality as it is, and then we have to progress along the path, as the mantra of Heart Sutra refers by this, by saying gade gade para gade para sam gade bodhisoha. So how do you overcome this reification that is within us? So in the sky of Dharmakaya, which is pure from the beginning, the elaborations or reifications of the clouds gather. So for us, whatever appears to have some objective existence, although there's no such a way of existence, but this appears to us, and accordingly we also cling on to such a way of existence of things. And so these myriad of things come from the spots of emptiness. And so how do we overcome this reification? Not by through the blessings of the lamas or the spiritual feats or from the deities and the enlightened activities of the Dharmapalas and so forth, but by using our intelligence, when we do critical analysis, these elaborations or reifications actually dissipate into the space, the reality space itself. So what appears to be of this multiplicity of things that appear to us, good, bad, and so forth, when you actually look at their the true nature, and you are able to, if you are able to sustain that insight, and then this child who is fatigued by the reification takes rest in this forest hut of ineffability. So, by meditating on the reality of things as it is, what happens is within the perspective of that very mind which sees the reality, then all this multiplicity of things actually disappear from its view. And because of that, when you come out of that meditation absorption in that emptiness, then you can actually see things as being like an illusion, and accordingly you can make progress in the conventional practices of compassion and so forth. And therefore, you have to actually search for the emptiness, because there is no other way out of no other way of liberation other than understanding this. So the elaboration can also be referred to our conceptions, the 80 different conceptions which appear from this innate clear luminous mind, and they also dissolve back into it. And therefore, if you can make your do your practice to such an extent that this actually happens to you, that the dissolution actually happens to you, then you will not be overcome with fatigue, which is caused by these 80 conceptions as well. And therefore, as to the best of your ability, you should meditate on emptiness. Having debated for many years on emptiness, if you are not able to actually integrate whatever you study about emptiness into your mind, then you are only someone who is carried away by the empty words. So even when you debate a single word, you should actually use that understanding to tame or subdue your mind. So beginning with your initial class in philosophy, the teacher actually has to introduce the students to this, that whatever they study and they debate on should be integrated within their mind and not be complacent about that. Which is not good. And therefore, I would like to request you to please combine your study, reflection, and meditation. Of course, there's no need for me to ask you to do this, but I just plead you to do that. So it's about... So around 10, at around 10 o'clock, we'll say this prayer of Master Tsongkhapa, so that I'll also get some rest, and also the chant master would have to clear his throat for this. So the actual determination, the chapter 10, misidentifying the object to be negated. The actual determination of reality has the section on actually... Page 139. How those systems of contradict this distinguishing feature of Madhyamaka. So the... Thus, the system of Nagarjuna, the protector, is that. So, when we the meaning of, if you can actually understand the meaning of lack of inherent existence as meaning that dependently things are dependently arisen, then it's really effective. So this has a very potential to dispel both the extremes of nihilism and eternalism. So in Nagarjuna's system, the things themselves as such on which we establish emptiness are not denied. They don't say these don't exist, but what is said is that they don't have any objective existence, because if that were the case, then they should not depend on any other factor. So, as Nagarjuna says in the 24th chapter of Mula Madhyamaka Karika, if you view things to have some objective existence, intrinsic existence, then you would also have to say that things do not depend on causes and conditions. So, just as an effect depends on a cause, likewise, the cause also is posited in relation to its effect. So although at the time of the cause itself, the effect has not yet arisen, but because the cause is going to give rise to that effect, it is called a cause. And therefore, in whatever situation, whether arising, abiding, or disintegrating, so we actually use a lot of conventions, although things may not be here right now, but because things will come in the future, we say, well, such and such thing is this and that. And therefore, the reason to prove that things have no intrinsic existence, the effects of what influences something else. And therefore, when we see things that related to each other, it shows that something is dependent on something else. And therefore, being dependent and being independent are mutually exclusive. Either things have to be one or the other. So this is something which is obvious to us. And therefore, because things are dependently arisen, because things are dependent, therefore, they don't have any independent existence. And therefore, they arise in dependence on causes and conditions. And therefore, that things can be posited only through name and our concepts. And therefore, they are merely in name and in name and concept. And to this, to what is conventional, nothing can, no other conventionality can undermine it. No other conventional cognition can undermine it. And also the ultimate analysis into things will not undermine it. And therefore, they are said to be conventional. So if things have any intrinsic existence, then the cyclic existence and samsara, nirvana, and so forth would be impossible. So reading through the text, since it is inappropriate not to give those teachings, all the teachings on bondage, freedom, and etc. should be set forth. Thus, you definitely must assert the absence of intrinsic existence. However, you misinterpret of Madhyamaka seem to say, as things have no essential or intrinsic nature, then what else is there? Therefore, it is not necessary to add a qualification such as ultimate when refuting bondage, freedom, production, cessation, etc. Bondage, etc. are refuted by the arguments that refute intrinsic existence. If you say this, think about how you should not contradict that which allows you, in the absence of intrinsic existence, to posit bondage, freedom, arising, disintegration, and so forth. Objection. This master, Sanjakirti, holds that teachings on cyclic existence and nirvana, bondage, freedom, etc., are made conventionally, and we also accept these conventionally. Hence, there is no fault. And the reply. This is not reasonable. For you also accept the Master Chandrakirti's decision that phenomena have no essential or intrinsic nature, even conventionally. The argument refuting intrinsic existence must refute it even conventionally, and you claim that the argument refuting intrinsic existence also refutes bondage, freedom, etc. Therefore, it is quite clear that in your system, bondage, freedom, and so forth are refuted even conventionally. In brief, if you claim that the absence of intrinsic existence contradicts bondage, freedom, production, cessation, etc., then it will be impossible in terms of either truth to give the full and correct teaching on nirvana and cyclic existence within emptiness, the emptiness of intrinsic existence. You have therefore denied the unique feature of Madhyamaka. If you claim that the absence of intrinsic existence does not contradict bondage and such, then you are left without any good reason with which to support your claim. Without having to add any qualification such as ultimate to what is negated, the argument refuting intrinsic existence also refutes production, etc. Therefore, if the argument refuting intrinsic existence refutes cause and effect, then you are asserting that production, disintegration, and such are impossible in the absence of intrinsic existence. In that case, it is quite clear that your position does not differ in the slightest from the essentialist argument set forth in the 24th chapter of Nagarjuna's Madhyamaka. If these were empty, there would be neither arising nor disintegration. It follows that for you, the noble truths would not exist. Nor does your position differ or at all from the essentialist arguments set forth in Nagarjuna's refutations of objections. If all things are completely without intrinsic nature, we are on the next section, how the Madhyamaka responds to those who neglect the distinguishing feature of Madhyamaka. So reading the quotations from Master Nagarjuna's fundamental treatise. So as I said, explained earlier, you take your own fallacies and then turn them into ours, like someone who is while riding on a horse forgets that very horse. So this is about the intrinsic, accepting intrinsic existence. So if you regard things as existing intrinsically, then you regard all things as having no cause or conditions. Also, if all these phenomena were not empty, there would be neither arising nor disintegration. If it would follow that for you, essentialists, the Four Noble Truths would not exist. And there are other such passages. Therefore, it is clear that those who argue, if there is no essential or intrinsic existence, then what else is there, have unquestionably failed to distinguish between the seedling's lack of intrinsic existence and a seedling's lack of existence. Because of that, they have also failed to distinguish between the existence of a seedling and the existence of a seedling by way of its own essence. Therefore, they clearly hold that whatever exists must exist essentially, and if something is not essentially existent, then it does not exist. Otherwise, why would they claim that the arguments refuting essential existence refute mere existence and mere production and cessation, etc.? They claim that insofar as seedlings and such are asserted to exist, they must exist essentially, and they claim that if seedlings utterly lack essential existence, they must be utterly non-existent. In taking these positions, they deniably fall to both extremes of permanence and of annihilation. Thus, their perspective is no different from that of the essentialist. For Chandrakirti's commentary on Aryadeva's 400 stanzas clearly states, the essentialists say that whenever things exist, there is essence. As they see it, without essence, these things would be completely non-existent, like the horn of a donkey. Therefore, these essentialists cannot avoid being proponents of both extremes of permanence and of annihilation. Consequently, it is difficult to reconcile all of their explicit assertions. The glorious Chandrakirti distinguishes intrinsic existence from existence. He also distinguishes the absence of intrinsic existence from non-existence. Unless you know this, you will no doubt fall to both extremes, and thus you will not know the meaning of the middle way, which is without extremes.
Mm-hmm.
For when it turns out that a phenomenon utterly lacks essential existence for you, it'll be utterly non-existent. Then, since there will be no way at all to posit cause and effect within emptiness, emptiness of intrinsic existence, you will fall to an extreme of annihilation. Also, once you accept that a phenomenon exists, you will have to assert that it essentially exists. In that case, it'll be impossible for you to treat cause and effect as similar to illusions in the sense that they appear to exist intrinsically, whereas they do not. Consequently, you will fall to the extreme of permanence. Therefore, to avoid falling to the extreme of existence, you must realize that from the outset all phenomena lack even a particle of essential existence. And to escape the extreme of non-existence, you must develop definite knowledge that things such as seedlings nevertheless have the power to perform their own functions. That is, they do not turn into non-things, which are empty of the capacity to perform functions. A clear differentiation between the absence of intrinsic existence and non-existence is set forth in Chandrakirti's clear words. Objection. This claim that things lack intrinsic existence will wipe out everything that Bhagwan has said, such as you experience the fruition of the karma that you yourself have done. By making this claim, you mistakenly deny karma and its effects. Therefore, you are the supreme nihilist. Reply, we are not nihilists. We refute both the propositions of existence and proposition of non-existence. We eliminate the path free from these two and the path that leads to the city of nirvana. We also do claim karma, agents, effects, and so forth do exist. What do we say? That we posit that these lack intrinsic nature. Objection. So it's about on page 144, Chandrakirti's commentary on the 400 verses. So, in of course, the term dependent origination is used by all the four different philosophical schools, but the Madhyamakas use this as the reasoning to, of course, the cause and effects have their own identity. They hold their own identity. So the realists actually say that things arise from their own causes and conditions. Therefore, there is something intrinsic or essential in the cause to give rise to their respective effects. And it's not the case that we can actually concoct anything with our concepts. And Chandrakirti is replying to them here. So what is the meaning of dependent arising? There are two meanings. One is the dependent origination in terms of causality, how causes give rise to their effects. So effects, in other words, effects depending on their causes. And the other is the dependent origination in terms of how things are designated. Not only that, defects depend on their causes, but the causes themselves also are dependent on the effects. And similarly, a whole is dependent on its parts, and the parts are dependent on the whole. So they are mutually dependent. As Madhyamaka Avatara says, so there is this dependence by designation. So in the commentary on Madhyamaka Avatara by Lama Tsongkhapa, there is this mention of how a whole is dependent on its parts. So those who deny, even in convention, the objective existence can say that they say that things are posited by designation also. And so there is some difference in saying that things are designated and things are posited by designation and mere designation. If we look at Lama Tsongkhapa's commentary on Madhyamaka Avatara, and then in his Ocean of Reasoning, he says that when we say things are merely in name, It doesn't mean that the object which the name refers to is not denied, nor the name itself is not also nor do we deny the name itself being existent. Although we name things, but if we will to look at the object itself, to try to search for the object within that object that is referred by the name, then of course nothing can be found in it. But then things have influence on us, impact on us, and therefore by default what we can decide is that there is things are merely existent by merely by way of name or designation. And so in Lama Tsongkhapa's Ocean of Reasoning commentary on Madhyamaka Mula Madhyamaka Karika, he says there can be two ways of how things can exist, either from its own side objectively or by way of name designation. And since things cannot be found to have any objective existence, therefore the conclusion is that there's no other choice but to say that they are merely designated. And then it says in the text, it means that the absence of intrinsic existence, it means no intrinsically existent production, it means the arising of effect whose nature is similar to a magician's illusion, a mirage of reflection, a phantom city, an emanation or a dream. It means emptiness and selflessness. And Chandrakirti shows that by asserting dependent arising, you can avoid the extremes, the position that things exist and the position that things do not exist. He avoids the position that things exist by explaining that dependent arising means no intrinsically existing production, and he avoids the position that things do not exist by... So here the nature is refers to what is to be negated, the object of negation. So when we talk about that things have no intrinsic existence, so the essentialist position that things exist refers only to intrinsic existence, thing. In the position that things do not exist refers to things that perform functions. For page 145, for in avoiding those two extremes, Chandrakirti refutes intrinsic existence and indicates that there do exist cause and effects that are like a magician's illusion. Moreover, Chandrakirti's commentary on the 400 stanzas says, question, do you Madhyamakas claim that there are no memory consciousness that have as their objects the things of the past? Reply, you who claim that such do not exist? You would claim that such do not exist? We do not eliminate dependent arising. The Master Aryadeva himself gives a precise statement of how memory exists. And there's a quotation from Aryadeva's 400 verses. And in the next passage, the lines from Aryadeva's text says, therefore, the arising of what we call memory is only as unreal subject with an unreal object. Therefore, what memory observes is something in the past. If the past thing essentially existed, then the memory of it would be observing an object that essentially exists. Therefore, that memory would be essentially existent. So the memory would actually remember the thing by coming in contact with the thing. But insofar as that past thing lacks intrinsic existence, the memory observing it also lacks intrinsic existence. Therefore, Aryadeva has established that the past object and the memory are of it are unreal. Unreal means only lacking intrinsic existence and dependent arising. It does not mean the non-existence of things that can perform functions. A past thing is not entirely non-existent because it is an object of memory and its effects can be seen. It also does not essentially exist, for if it did, it would have to be permanent and it would have to be directly apprehensible. Chandrakirti says these that these past objects and such are not utterly non-existent and are also not essentially existent. He explains that the unreal or false means being a dependent arising and does not mean that things do not exist. Therefore, if you claim that these phenomena are essentially existent, then you are a proponent of real things. You have fallen to the extreme of intrinsic existence. However, to hold that these phenomena are simply existing does not make you a proponent of real things or a proponent of a real existence. Similarly, if you hold that internal and external things are non-things devoid of the capacity to perform functions, then you are propounding the non-existence of things, and you have fallen to the extreme of non-existence. However, you do not fall to an extreme of non-existence by saying that things lack intrinsic existence. Some Tibetans who claim to be Madhyamakas do not distinguish utter non-existence from the absence of intrinsic existence and do not distinguish essential existence from mere existence. They hope to avoid falling to the extremes of existence and non-existence simply by saying, we do not claim that things are non-existent. We say that they are not existent. We do not claim that things exist. We say that they are non-existent, not non-existent. This is nothing but a mass of contradictions. It does not in the least explain the meaning of the middle way. For when they refute others, they perform their refutation via an investigation of whether or not something intrinsically exists. Therefore, they have to limit the possibilities to two. It intrinsically exists, or it intrinsically exists, or it does not. Yet, in making their own assertions, they claim there is something that is neither of those two. Why should they have to limit the possibilities to two when they investigate something to see whether or not it intrinsically exists? Because if there were a third possibility beyond these two, it would not be reasonable to investigate the question, which is it, intrinsically existent or not intrinsically existent? It would be as though there were a color and someone asked, is it blue or is it yellow? Limiting things to two possibilities, either intrinsically exist or they do not, derives from the universal limitation that anything imaginable either exists or does not exist. Similarly, the limitation that what truly exists must either truly exist as a single or truly exist as plural, as based on the universal limitation that anything must be either single or plural. When there is such a limitation, any further alternative is necessarily precluded. Hence, it is utter nonsense to assert a phenomena that is neither of those two, as Nagarjuna's refutation of objection says. If the absence of intrinsic nature were refuted, then the presence of intrinsic nature would be proven. Moreover, there will be always some doubt in the minds of those who make these claims, because they have no way of making a definitive list that excludes any further alternative. This is because, as they see it, the exclusion of one possibility, such as exists or does not exist, does not entail the other possibility. If they accept that there are some cases, such as is and is not, which excludes any further alternative, then they should know that it is exactly the same in the case of exists and does not exist. Even their position is an overly literal misunderstanding of Madhyamaka texts that say is not existent and is not non-existent. Therefore, if, as they claim, it is inappropriate to say exists or does not exist, then it will also be wrong to say is not existent and is not non-existent, because those Madhyamaka texts say they should reject all four possibilities. Therefore, Nagarjuna's fundamental treatise does not refer to simple existence and non-existence when it states, to say it exists is a conception of permanence. To say it does not exist is a view of annihilation. Hence, the learned should not dwell in either existence or non-existence. This clearly means that the person who claims that things intrinsically exist will have views of permanence and annihilation. Chandrakirti's clear words explain that in this passage, the conception of existence and non-existence refers to the view that things exist and the view that things do not exist. And then it then says, why is it that when you have the view that things exist and the view that things do not exist, it follows that you have views of permanence and of annihilation. As Nagarjuna's fundamental treatise says, whatever exists intrinsically is permanent since it does not become non-existent. If you say that an intrinsically existent thing that arose before is now non-existent, then that entails an extreme of annihilation. Since intrinsic existence is not overcome, something that is said to be intrinsically existent would never become a non-existent. Thus, the assertion that something is intrinsically existent entails a view of permanence. Also, a view of annihilation is entailed by the assertion that there was intrinsic nature in things at an earlier time, but it has now been destroyed and no longer exists. So Chandrakirti calls the assertion of intrinsic existence a view of permanence and says that if you assert the latter destruction of what was formerly intrinsically existent, such is a view of nihilism. He does not say this is of mere existence or mere disintegration. Also, Buddha Palita's commentary on the fundamental treatise clearly explains that when Nagarjuna says whatever exists intrinsically is permanent and so forth, he is indicating the type of permanence of and the type of annihilation he meant when he explained that to say exists or to say does not exist is to have views of permanence or annihilation. In brief, if you claim that emptiness, which is absence of intrinsic existence, is not the sublime emptiness taught by the Buddha, and you refute it, then you will be reborn in a miserable realm due to having abandoned the true teaching, the perfection of wisdom. If you take an interest in the absence of intrinsic existence, but think, if there is no intrinsic existence, what is there? And then claim that all phenomena do not exist at all, you will still fall into the shallow chasm of a view of annihilation. Similarly, Nagarjuna's fundamental treatise says, if they view emptiness in the wrong way, those of the limited intelligence will be ruined. Commenting on this, Chandrakirti clearly says, if on the one hand you were to think all is empty, that is, does not exist, then you would be viewing emptiness in the wrong way. In this vein, Nagarjuna says, if this teaching is misunderstood, it ruins the unwise, for they sink into the filth of nihilistic views. On the other hand, suppose that you do not deny all phenomena, but then say, we have seen these things. How could they be empty? Therefore, an absence of intrinsic existence is not what emptiness means. In that case, you have definitely abandoned emptiness. After you have abandoned emptiness in this way, you will definitely be reborn in a miserable realm due to this action of depriving yourself of the true teaching, as Nagarjuna's precious garland says. Further, if they misunderstand this, fools who take pride in their supposed wisdom will destroy themselves by abandoning it and fall headfirst to the unrelenting hell. Quam, if we claimed that there were real things and then later view them as non-existent, then we would have a view of annihilation. However, we do not accept their existence from the outset. What is annihilated so as to make this view of annihilation, for Nagarjuna's treatise says, if you say that what arose before is now non-existent, that entails annihilation. Thus, Nagarjuna says that such a view is annihilation. Such is the view of annihilation. Also, Chandrakirti's clear words says, yogis do not fall to the two extremes. If they know the conventional truth, which are produced only by ignorance, lack intrinsic existence, and then know that the emptiness of those has the character of the ultimate, they think, how could something which has now become non-existent have existed then? Since they do not regard earlier things as having had intrinsic nature, they do not think that such later become non-existent. Reply, this is not reasonable. Your supposition is that in order to have a view of annihilation, one must assert an earlier existence of whatever thing is annihilated later. In that case, it would absurdly follow that even the Lokayata proponents of materialism would not have a view of annihilation. But it is not their claim that past and future lives, karma and effects, etc., once existed and later became non-existent. They do not accept such as having existed in the first place. Therefore, when Nagarjuna said, if you say that what arose before is now non-existent, that entails annihilation, he meant that proponents of existence who assert that things have an essential or intrinsic nature will unquestionably have views of permanence on annihilation. For if they claim that this intrinsic nature never changes, then they will have a view of permanence. If they claim that it once existed and was later destroyed, then they will have a view of annihilation. Madhyamakas do not accept the existence of even a particle of essential or intrinsic nature. This fact proves that they lack one type of view of annihilation, the type in which it is held that an intrinsic nature that once existed is later destroyed. It does not prove that they have eliminated all views of annihilation. In a different way, Madhyamakas are also unlike those who have the other type of view of annihilation, a view in which it is held that karma and its effect do not exist. This is set forth at length in Chandrakirti's clear words as follows. So, he's finished this chapter actually, and we are into the next chapter, chapter 12. So, chapter 12, Rational Analysis, showing that Madhyamaka critique does not eradicate conventional existence, has four parts. So, arising and cessation as they are posited conventionally without doing any critical analysis into their nature, of course, we can accept. We do not have to look into it. So, Solomon's commenting on page number 156, the second last paragraph. So, so if something were to exist when something were to be found when a critical analysis into its nature is done, then of course it cannot be refuted by that critical analysis into the nature of things, because that finds it. So conventional consciousness established the production and cessation of forms and such. Although forms and such exist, the reasoning consciousness does not establish them. Therefore, while reason does not find forms and such, why? How could it refute them? For example, a visual consciousness does not find sounds, but this does not refute them. This is similar. Therefore, if production, cessation, and so forth existed essentially, page 157, that is... were established in reality, then reason would have to find them, because it accurately analyzes whether forms and such have essentially exist in production and cessation. Since such analysis does not find production and so forth, it refutes production, cessation, and so forth that exist essentially, that is, in reality. For if they existed essentially, that analysis would have to find them, but it does not in the East. It does not. For example, when a searcher who is certain to find a pot in the East, if it is there, searches in the East for a pot and does not find it, this refutes the existence of a pot in the East. Yet, how could it refute the mere existence of a pot? Similarly, Madhyamaka analysis is certain to find essentially existent production if such exists. When it does not find production, this constitutes a refutation of intrinsically or essentially existent production. How could it refute mere production? In this vein, Chandrakirti's commentary on the 400 stanzas says, is clear. Therefore, when reason analyzes in this way, there is no essential nature that exists in the sensory faculty, object, or consciousness. Hence, they have no essential existence. If they essentially exist, then under analysis by reason, their status as essentially existent would be seen even more clearly, but it is not. Therefore, they are established as empty of intrinsic nature. Chandrakirti repeatedly allows that these conventionalities, such as form and sound, do not exist. However, they are not in the least established. By reasoning that analyzes reality, that is, analyzes whether they have intrinsic nature. Thus, the scrutiny of reason is not applied to them. Also, Chandrakirti often says that it is those who are incompetent at positing the conventionalities who claim that conventionalities are destroyed when, upon rational analysis, reason does not find them. If reasoning that analyzes whether they have intrinsic nature could refute them, then you would have to apply intense rational scrutiny to these conventionalities, that is, forms, feelings, and so forth. However, the texts of this master completely refute such efforts. Therefore, it is those who have wandered very far from the middle way who claim that something is invalidated when it is not found by reasoning that analyzes whether it has intrinsic nature. Similarly, a meditative equipoise of a noble being does not see the production and cessation of forms and so forth. So when a visual consciousness sees a form, of course, in terms of seeing the form itself, the form as such, it is not mistaken. But because there is this appearance of the form to have some kind of objective existence, therefore that sight, visual consciousness is mistaken from the point of view of that appearance of the form, the objective appearance of the form. Therefore, even some earlier scholars, not to mention those today, seem to have erred by not differentiating and instead considering identical the following pairs. Number one, something unable to withstand rational analysis versus something invalidated by reason. Number two, the non-perception of production and cessation by a noble being's wisdom of meditative equipoise versus the perception of production and cessation as non-existent by a noble being's wisdom of meditative equipoise. And number three, the non-discovery of production and cessation by a reasoning consciousness which analyzes whether they intrinsically exist versus the discovery that production and cessation are non-existent. Therefore, the intelligence should analyze this in detail and make careful distinctions. In saying this, we do not assert that the conventional consciousness is more powerful than knowledge of the ultimate, nor do we assert that conventional consciousness contradicts knowledge of the ultimate. However, you claim that rational analysis of reality refutes conventional forms, feelings, and so forth when it analyzes them and does not find them. It does not refute them. In fact, mundane knowledge will contradict any attempt to refute conventional phenomena. So page 195 finished. 160. The passage referring to the barren woman should be understood as follows. If reason refuted production, then production, like the son of a barren woman, the horns of her hair and such, would be a non-thing, empty of all function. In that case, there would be a fallacy that dependent arisings would not exist. We are wary of that. Hence, we do not say that it is like the non-production of something devoid of the capacity to perform functions, such as the son of a barren woman. We say that production is like a magician's illusion and so forth. Therefore, we refute truly existent and not and or intrinsically exist in production. Also, Chandragupta's commentary on 400 stanzas says, "Objection." And so also comment on this quotation from Chandragupta. So Shantideva says that we are actually saying the means to, talking about the means to seize the conception which perceives or conceives a true existence and things. So hence Chandragupta very clearly states exactly what reason does and does not refute. Therefore, once he makes these distinctions in one passage, they must be applied even when they are not stated in all similar passages throughout the text. Therefore, reason refutes essential existence, objective existence found on the side of the thing itself. It does not refute mere existence. Since he says that reason is intent on seeking intrinsic nature, reason seeks to discover whether something intrinsically exists. Therefore, this means that a refutation by such analysis is a refutation of intrinsic existence. Hence, distinguish these two. Chandragupta does not refute that such instances are results of karma. Moreover, he says that Madhyamakas must assert this. The continuation of that passage says, therefore, the learners do not subject worldly objects to the analysis such just explained. That is, the analysis congruent with the perception of reality. Instead, they accept that worldly objects are simply simply the inconceivable results of karma. They accept the whole world as though it were an emanation projected by another emanation. So, when you present the two truths, does the line of reasoning that establish ultimate contradict the presentation of conventional? It does. If it does, then your presentation of the two truths contradicts itself. In that case, how can you have perfected the skill of presenting the two truths? If, on the other hand, there is no trace of internal contradiction in your presentation of the two truths, then it is a contradiction to claim that the line of reasoning that established the ultimate refutes the presentation of conventionalities. Chandragupta's clear words also says, so unskilled in ultimate it, so the realists, according to them, if you sometimes apply analytical standards inappropriately and destroy the conventional, and because we are skilled in positing conventional truths, we stay with the world's position, and we use its conventional standards to overturn the standards that you set, so as to eliminate the category of conventionalities. Likewise, the elders of the world, we derive out only you who deviate from the traditional standards of the world. We do not drive out conventionalities. Thus he says that he refutes only proponents of tenets that deviate from conventionalities. And 61 finished. So while remembering the great good qualities, excellent qualities of the body, speech, and mind of Master Tsongkhapa, we'll say the prayer of Master Tsongkhapa written by Kedubje, and after that follow it with song of mystic experiences of Lama Tsongkhapa. And then we'll also say the prayer of Lama Tsongkhapa and his two disciples by the first Dalai Lama, which is called Shar Kangri Ma. Magnificent, precious root guru, glory of the triple ground, it says, the praise. Magnificent, precious root guru, lotus seated at our hearts. Through your great kindness, held by your great compassion, bestow powers of body, speech, and mind. Lone eye of beings of the triple ground, triple levels. liberation seekers, protector, unsurpassed, great compassion, more than all the conquerors, purest supreme guru, I pray to you. Bodhisattvas' deeds adopted, witnessed by conquerors in Tuchita as Jambel Nyingpo, well-renowned, in the snowland known as glorious Losan Trakpa, heir of the conquerors, I pray to you. I pray to you, replete with the education of excellent teachings, Sanskrit, grammar, and science, all learned without effort, all learned without effort by the power of the ripening of your merits, vast expanse, emerging from your mother's water holder. Amidst the lightning flashes of samsara's flirtations, not consorting, but illuminating all to the sun of your form, I humbly make request. In youth, all conquerors' austerities performed, upholding supreme moral discipline, bound, lifelong, familiar with restraints, powerful one, to you I make request. Discerning, unhindered, entering the words and meaning of the conqueror's excellent speech, always seeking to practice their advice, vast mind of knowledge, to you I make request. I pray to you, I, for all phenomena, omitting none, undefiled, subtle, meticulous ability, never satisfied with streams of babble, supreme sage of 10 million difficult points. Your speech trained in all debates and 100 answers analyzed, even the slightest distortion abandoned, pure, powerful mind, I pray to you. Who else but you, seeing just as they are, the texts of the great Indian chariots and all the excellent teachings arising as supreme advice, to you alone I pray. Wherever on the ocean clad your feet may rest, on the ocean clad your feet may rest, the mark left in the dust becomes an eternal place of offering and so on. Crown of all supreme scholars, to you I pray. However much even the conquerors probe the pure moral practices in your mind of the subtle fault of slacking your deeds, not a whit of to see abandoned, to you I pray. Mass of water, source of treasure, such is the depth of your compassion. Eye of wisdom beyond all objects, compassion's mind, Lord, to you I pray. Your extraordinary thought, the carriage will not leave the burden of being's welfare still to board. The end of the great waves of deeds is reached. Excellent courage, to you I make request. Protector, if even your breath becomes medicine for all migrating beings, what need to mention your two collections deeds? Friend of the triple ground, born, I pray to you. Daily from Manjushri straight to you, a nectar stream of teachings, eloquence. This three times conqueror's mind essence distilled, continuum uncut, to you I make request. Call son of conquerors on the lotus grove of teachings in this world, directly placed by protector Mepham as Ajita, as supreme. Sweet sigh of relief, I pray to you. Victory flag of countless Buddhas, seen by many mighty yogis, direct blessed Saraha, Luihipa, and the rest, totally pure, supreme, I pray to you. Nagarjuna, Avayadeva, Buddha Palita, life blessed by Chandrakirti's flowers, then in subtle suchness, stains of error, all cast aside, I make request to you. I pray to you, never distracted, good in meditation, supreme concentration, in absorption on sky-like suchness, and afterwards in illusion-like mind. Indistinguishable from Lord Vajradhara in analyzing precisely the ocean of Vajrayana, the ultimate of the subduous, excellent teachings, Supreme Lama, to you I make request. In achieving the two stages, the paths end. Having seen just as they are the subtle points in this uncharted field of uncrossed by others, to you who practice the essence, I make request. having completed the deity yoga, gross and subtle, far from desire for vulgar false appearance, whatever arises by the play of the mandala, wheel your mind undistracted. To you I make request. Superstitions, course of winds, dissolved into the duty. Clear light, seeing all as empty suchness, whatever arises, having the play of supreme bliss, Vajra mind possessor, I pray to you. Limitless prayers, by powerful, skillful means, effortless achievements, leading hosts of disciples onto the path, pleasing to the conquerors, protector of all worlds, I pray to you. I make request to you who illuminated the three training scriptures and realizations of all the conquerors' holy dharma, when the virtuous trainees were nothing but symbols of practice and training in mere definitions, turning remnants of the doctrine into just words, when you emanate in this realm at will, collections of sky-bound heroes, darkenees, gather close and enter your heart, into your heart, offering to you who are sky beyond thought, I pray. When the clear light Dharmakaya manifested in the Bardo, your form became a mass of light, supremely illusory form, Sambhogakaya. To you, the one who attained this, I pray. From this day on, in all my future life births, by respectfully offering to your lotus feet, listening to your words, bless me to accomplish your body, speech, and mind what pleases you, having abandoned all desire for pleasure and selfish peace, riches and honor, the appearance of this life, bless me never to part from supreme bodhicitta, the thought to help all migrating beings. By incisive intelligence, subtle and wise, following reason, having internalized without omission the meaning of all the conqueror's teachings, please bless me to clear the great darkness of the ignorance of my creators. Having ascertained the meaning of the Vajrayana's many aspects, unmoved by all obstacles, outer and inner, bless me to practice one-pointedly and reach the profound meaning of the two stages, the end of the good path. In short, having learned well all the pure dharma of the conquerors, the original thought exactly as intended, particularly the highest Vajra vehicle, bless me to be a guide for transmigrators. By this virtue, in all my lives, unseparated from you, Lama, supreme guide, protector, nourish me with the taste of this nectar source, your excellent teaching, the essence of your mind. All the virtuous work are to be done and being done by myself and others, however much there is following what pleases you, may it be accomplished just as you advised. Conqueror Tsongkhapa, in all my lives, by the direct power of the supreme vehicle, the virtuous friend, may I never turn back, even for a moment, from this good path praised by the conquerors. Having unmistakably realized bodhicitta, the supporting beam of the supreme vehicle, the two stages and the points of the pure view, by my effort, may I accomplish the essence of your speech. Through study and practice, may I see, as Prim advised, the Sutra, Tripitaka, and four classes of Tantra. May the glory of Losan Thakpa bring good fortune to spread the supreme teachings of the sage always and everywhere.
Chagama deyor. Zamyan dobar majunji.
son like Prince of the Conqueror, whose wisdom vast as the heavens has the brilliance of knowledge that sees what ultimately is and what merely seems to be. O venerable Lord of Dharma, most perfect Guru, the dust of your feet I place on my crown. Even the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas who fill the ten directions cannot describe the excellence of your body, speech, and mind. Yet, out of passionate inspiration, I shall sing them. Pray, listen for but a few moments. As a blossoming garland of flowers to adorn the necks of the clear-minded, and as a precious jewel to enhance the force of conviction, this song, in praise of your oceans of splendor to delight all sages, I have composed. Like a cloud, a merit of your superb deeds releases a torrent of rain that swells the virtue of those to be trained and proclaims with the dragon's thundering roar the sweetness of the vast and profound, O glorious, powerful, billowing Lama, foremost of tantric adepts, the mighty yogi who mastered the many millions of samadhis, composed faultless expositions and made true efforts in practice, most splendid of lamas, you tower over the heads of all. At Vajrasana, in a former birth to the victorious one, you offered a rosary of 100 crystal beads. Thus, you acquired the fortune later to attain the perfect view. O illustrious Lama, at your feet I may pay homage. At the age of 7, you directly perceived the Bhankara Atisha, the great path clearer, and Vajrapani, Lord of Secrets. The exhortations of both the sutras and the tantras dawned upon you, O illustrious Lama. At your feet I pay homage. O Jitun, Lord of phenomenal existence, you directly perceive Manjushri, Bodhisattva of wisdom of emptiness, as the color of a perfect sapphire. O illustrious Lama, at your feet I pay homage. From this time onwards, O High One, whenever you desire to, you could invoke Manjushri, treasure of stainless wisdom, and constantly listen to the teaching of both Sutrayana, Transcendent Wisdom, and Tantrayana Secret Assembly. O illustrious Lama, at your feet I pay homage. When practicing the seven-limb ritual of the 35 purification Buddhas, continually and clearly you beheld them and all their forms, mudra, symbols. O illustrious Lama, at your feet I pay homage. Seated in the auspicious posture, hands in the Dharma teaching mudra, Buddha Maitreya prophesied that just as the Sugatas who possess the 10 powers, you will one day perform the 12 acts of a supreme universal teacher. O illustrious Lama, at your feet I pay homage. Victorious master of both this birth, life, and death, truth, visions you've received of Amitabha Buddha, the medicine Buddha, and that teacher of men and gods, Shakyamuni, prince of the Shakya throne, each with a retinue vast as the oceans, O illustrious Lama, at your feet I pay homage. Saintly Tara, source of all cities, Ushnisha Vijaya, the one exalted and radiant, Ushnisha Siddhata Patra, dispeller of obstacles, and other such mystic female Buddhas, again and again you directly perceived, O illustrious Lama, at your feet I pay homage. Bodhisattva Nagarjuna, Aryadeva, holy Buddha Pali, the magnificent Dharma Chandrakirti, and the mighty Yogi Nagabodhi appeared, then constantly cared for you. O illustrious Master, at your feet I pay homage. Exalted as Sangha who delights the three worlds, the brother of Subandhu, a second Buddha, and Dignaka, child of Manjushri, appeared to and then constantly care for you. O illustrious Lama, at your feet I pay homage. Dhammakirti, a moon amongst teachers, as well as Gunaprabha, Shakyaprabha, Shandideva, and the glorious Abhaya Kara, appeared to then constantly care for you. O illustrious Lama, at your feet I pay homage. All the Mahasiddhas of India and Tibet, such as Indra Bodhi, Saraha, Luipa, and Krishna Charan, Trilpupa Gandharvata Tilupa and Naropa appeared to then cared constantly care for you. O illustrious Lama, at your feet I pay homage. Clearly, Manjushri prophesied that relying upon these lineages, you will produce colossal spiritual boons for yourself and for all sentient beings. Great bold one who spontaneously fulfills the wishes of the world, O illustrious Lama, at your feet I pay homage. When the samadhi of the yoga combining mental tranquility with cognition of emptiness increased like the waxing moon, you beheld the form of the destroyer Yamantaka, opponent of Lord of Death, complete with all mudras and expressions. O illustrious Lama, at your feet I pay homage. Having touched your heart to the wisdom, having touched your heart with the wisdom sword of Manjushri, a stream of undefiled ambrosia flowed into the depth of your being, spontaneously arousing the propitious absorption of highest joy. O illustrious Lama, at your feet I pay homage. Prayer for rebirth in the land of bliss and a eulogy of perfect intent of the dauntless protector Maitreya Buddha, as well as their graduated levels of meaning Manjushri illicitly conveyed to you who recorded and skillfully presented them. O illustrious Lama, at your feet I pay homage. Whenever you consecrated a religious image, the wisdom beings actually entered into the symbolic beings. This host of deities that you summoned still generates fields of merit within beings. O illustrious Lama, at your feet I pay homage. One night you dreamt of Nagarjuna and his five spiritual sons, amongst them discussing and his spiritual sons amongst them discussing the fabric of dependent origination. From their midst came Buddha Palita, who touched you with a scripture. The very next day within you arose the mind of a high one. O illustrious one, Malama, at your feet I pay homage. By focusing on the pith of the six branches of Kala Chakra, the wheel of time, you directly perceived his Buddha form. He foretold that soon you would equal even King Suchandra. O illustrious Lama, at your feet I pay homage. When for the first time you had led the great prayer festival of Lhasa, 100 magical omens appeared at your feet. At making this joyous offering, the Buddhas and their sons in the 10 directions were filled with supreme delight. O illustrious Lama, at your feet I pay homage. Generating the form of great bliss deity through the yoga of non-duality of profound luminosity and illusory appearances, you attained the Vajra Yoga body. O illustrious one, you, at your feet I pay homage. By practicing mantric signs of inhaling and exhaling Om Ahum on the lotus heart, the vital energies entered the central nadi, rested at breathing stopped and then dissolved. Thus, you experienced the clear light, Mahamudra, the great seal, attaining the Vajra Yoga speech. O illustrious Lama, at your feet I pay homage. Raising the navel chakra's mystic heat, which rests at the base of the central channel, the latter hum at the crown of your head melted and fell to your heart as spontaneously the experience of blisses dawned upon you. Simultaneously, the experience of bliss dawned upon you. Thus, you attained the Vajra Yoga mind. O illustrious Lama, at your feet I pay homage. Having been invoked as witnesses to your pure and perfect aspirations, all Buddhas and Bodhisattvas came forth. Only when you had summoned each of them into his respective position did you honor them with offerings. O illustrious Lama, at your feet I pay homage. While contemplating the principal mandala of Manjushri Vajra, Guha Samaja,
Guhyasamaja, you dreamt the Maitreya and Manjushri who were speaking of Dharma, passed down to you a jeweled vase brimming with water, pretending that you would master all teachings. O illustrious Lama, at your feet I pay homage. On a throne adorned with precious gems sat the omniscient Garga Lama. What? The omniscient Budhun Rinchendra. The text of Guhyasamaja root tantra he gave to you, exhorting you to be its keeper. O illustrious Lama, at your feet I pay homage. Accepting this responsibility, with mudras and mantras thrice you touched the text to your hands. He touched the text to your hand. By its blessings, it became obvious that the tantra of separating and mixing obtained by Marpa of the southern hills or is the true oral tradition of the exalted Nagarjuna. O illustrious Lama, at your feet I pay homage. Your mind absorbed in the mystic circle of Heruka, Chakrasamvara, the wheel of perfect bliss, myriads of darkenies of the outer, inner, and secret places made your offerings of Vajra songs, transporting you in ecstasy. O illustrious Lama, at your feet I pay homage. In meditation, destroying the forces of darkness, you beheld that radiant Buddha, mighty demon tamer, having an aura as pure as burnished gold, more brilliant than a million suns. O illustrious Lama, at your feet I pay homage. Your being, having become indivisible from the body, speech, and mind of all the Buddhas, the might of the power of evil was subdued. As the Dharma protectors crushed the demon families, shrieks of defeated satanic forces resounded across the universe. O illustrious Lama, at your feet I pay homage. These multitudes of Dharma protectors that you brought under control in a previous eon had been subjected by Buddha Vajradhara to guard your doctrine. With profound reverence, they work this still. O illustrious Lama, at your feet I pay homage. That you would, after entering Parinirvana, sit in the presence of a dauntless Maitreya in Tushita, pure land of joy, and would be known as wisdom essence, was, O Lord of Life, rightly prophesied by both Manjushri and Vajrapani. O illustrious Lama, at your feet I pay homage. By the strength of this eulogy sung from the depths of pure love, may the afflictions of beings limitless as the sky be extinguished. In this and all future lives, may all be nurtured by true teachers and embraced by the sacred Dharma. May the innate wisdom of great bliss reign throughout the world. May the stains of erroneously grasping minds and its objects be uprooted. And may all be inspired quickly to become like you, a Jetun Lama. When the wisdom of learning, contemplation, and meditation overtake the earth, may the arts of deliberation, debate, and composition flourish. May the ordinary and supreme siddhis come to each and every practitioner, and may all be inspired quickly to become like you, O Jetun Lama. By the limitless oceans of merit having presented like the Samanda Bhadra clouds of offering spanning the sky, of having bared every negative imprint and downfall accumulated since infinity, of having rejoiced in the spirituality of those on the paths of enlightenment to enlightenment, and of having besieged the lamas to turn the wheel of Dharma and not to enter Parinirvana, may all beings experience peerless samadhi, may goodness swell like the waxing moon, and may the doctrine of the omniscient Tsongkhapa thrive until time's end.
There you go.
Jebu Kala Nyendrawa De Tongwe Mela Lama Ten Zin Samshin Samshin Na Yer Sun Na Minda Mindu Number Gevel Kwa
So the kindness of the Guru Master Tsongkhapa is inconceivable to the beings of the snow land. So I have no other, none other except you, Tsongkhapa and your disciples to take refuge in. As you are, your kindness is great to me. So from this time until I reach the essence of enlightenment, I have no one to rely upon as my protector or refuge, and I will not look for any other for refuge, and therefore please hook me with your compassion's hook. Although I cannot repay your kindness exactly, I will not let myself be swayed by negative emotions of attachment and aversion. And I will put work hard, but enthusiastically to preserve your teachings. In this land of snows, there are those who proclaim to be Dharma, to be the upholders of Dharma, but they hold other Dharma upholders, other teachers, to be sworn enemies. And I'm disillusioned by this. Now, can't say that, and the Lameta Shiv. So with this, we have remembered Master Tsongkhapa and invoked his blessings. We finished doing this. And sometimes some people on this occasion of the death anniversary of Master Tsongkhapa, there are people who actually read or recite the Essence of True Eloquence by Master Tsongkhapa, the treatise differentiating between the definitive and provisional meanings of the sutra of Buddha's teaching. So I would not have been here if there are people who, in Sera Monastery, they do this. People gather together to recite this text. So if you, whether you are gathering here in this hall or you are gathering in your own rooms or somewhere, it would be good to recite this, the whole text, or if not, in just the Madhyamaka part, it would be an offering in terms of practice to the Master Tsongkhapa. It would be very good. So with regard to the cultivation, training in the mind of the altruistic intention, Bodhicitta, there is no greater text than Shantideva's Guide to Bodhisattva Way of Life. And with regard to the Madhyamaka treatise, there are these texts by Master Tsongkhapa himself. So the text so the essence of true eloquence, then the commentary on
Mula Madhyamaka Karika, then commentary on Madhyamaka Karika, and then there is the great treatise, the insight part of Lamrim Chemo, and inside part of Lamrim, the middle-length Lamrim. So these five texts are, there's no compare to these regarding them. So once somebody asked me to give the transmission, the explanatory transmission of this text, we had no time so far, so these texts should be studied to understand the Madhyamaka philosophical view. So with regard to Bodhicitta, the most effective text is Shantideva's Guide to the Bodhisattva Way of Life, we should first, with regard to the view of emptiness, the Madhyamaka view, we should first be familiar with the text, these five texts written by Master Tsongkhapa, and then using these as leverage, then we can enter into or read the teaching or text written by Nagarjuna and so forth. So rather than reciting Mikzema hundreds of thousands of times, rather than doing that, if we could study these texts by Master Tsongkhapa, it may be much more effective. Gunkin Shanglawa has said that by reciting mantras and sending the rosary beads, rather than actually wearing away one's negative emotions, one is actually wearing away one's nails. So, just study, read through the text, these Madhyamaka texts by Master Tsongkhapa, not just flipping through the pages, but then reading them. So, regarding the sequence to study Lama Tsongkhapa's text, first study the inside part of Lamrim Chemo, and then the essence of true eloquence, and then you can study this ocean of reasoning, and then this inside part of the middle length, and finally the commentary to Madhyamaka Avatara of Chandrakirti. So I do not understand much, but I am. I came from the same land where Lama Tsongkhapa was born. So the spot where Lama Tsongkhapa was born was one day away, is one day away from where I was born, the spot where I was born. So because of this, I am saying that you should study in this way. Chapter 13 of Lamrim Chemo. We are talking about the valid cognition. Things are established by valid cognition. But then because we are so used to perceiving things having some kind of objective existence of things, so when people hear sometimes that there are things established by through valid cognition, people sometimes find it quite unacceptable. Kirub Nosan Gyatso has said, and also
one of the spiritual main spiritual students of spiritual sons or student of the seventh Dalai Lama, Changya Rebbe Dorje. Some of the youngsters from our own tradition, while clinging to some kind of a solidity in things, and actually assenting to that way of existence of things, although the object of negation by using the Madhyamaka reasoning, so by clinging to the terms such as solidity and truth and true existence and so forth, they actually, while doing this critical analysis into the nature of things, leave the solidity as it is and then try to negate something which they take to be the object of negation. And by doing that, Changya Rebbe Dorje says that when they do this kind of analysis, rather than actually finding the mother, which he refers to, by which he refers to the emptiness, rather than finding that mother, they might, in fact, shoo away the mother. So if we are not able to actually posit the validity of things in conventional terms, then we cannot talk about samsara and nirvana and attaining nirvana and so forth. So then how can Tantakriti's commentary on the middle way be correct? It's when it says the world is not valid in any way. Reply, that passage refutes the notion that the world's visual consciousness and such are valid with regard to reality. It does not refute reality regarding all objects. In this vein, Tantakriti's explanation of the middle way commentary says, accordingly, only noble beings are authorities on the contemplation of reality. Those who are not noble beings are not. Those who are not noble beings would be authority on reality if our acceptance of the world's critique meant that we accept the validity of the world's perception of our analysis of reality. The commentary on the middle way says, if the world were an authority, it would see reality. Then what needs would there be for those others, for those others called noble beings? What would be noble path what would the noble path accomplish? It is not right that fools should be authorities. In the commentary, the following explanation of the middle way commentary says, Chandrakirti says, because mere visual consciousness and such would ascertain reality, it would be fruitless to work at ethics or to study, reflect, and meditate in order to understand the noble path. However, this is not the case. Therefore, because the world is not valid in any way, the world has no critique in this context of reality. And so from this, on page 164, where it refers to the qualm refers to Chantakita's commentary on the 400 stanzas, the unique positions of the Madhyamaka, Prasangika Madhyamaka, are now being stated. It is quite inconsistent to all sensory consciousness perception and also to consider it valid with regard to other things. So valid here refers to valid in the sense that these consciousness also, to them, there's appearance of the true existence. As the world sees it, a valid cognition is simply a non-deceptive consciousness. However, the Bhagavan said that even consciousness, because it is composite, has a false and deceptive quality and is like a magician's illusion. That which has a false and deceptive quality and is like a magician's illusion is not non-deceptive because it exists in one way but appears in another.
It is not right to designate such a valid cognition, because it would be, it certainly follow that all consciousness would be valid cognition. So how the reply, unlike the passage "I, ear, and nose are not valid," this passage has been a source of grave doubt. Therefore, I will explain in detail. This refutation of the position that the visual consciousness and such are both perceptions and valid cognition is a refutation of the assertion of the logicians. Therefore, let us start by considering what they assert. Chandrakirti's commentary on 400 verses says, because these logicians are utterly unpracticed in the sensibilities of the world, you must train them from the very beginning like young children. Hence, in order to teach them, you question them closely, asking, what is the perception in your system? A consciousness is a perception. What sort of consciousness? One that is free from the conceptuality. What is this conceptuality? It is a fluctuation. So just as things appear, it is a fluctuation of discrimination that is involved in the superposition of names and types of objects. So with Master Chandrakirti and others who do not assert objective existence even conventionally, they say this. As will be, we will explain that Master Chandrakirti does not accept even conventionally that anything exists essentially or by way of its intrinsic character. Thus, how could he accept this claim that the sensory consciousness is valid with regard to intrinsic character of their objects? Therefore, this refutation of the claim that sensory consciousnesses are valid in refutation or valid is a refutation of the view that they are valid with regard to intrinsic character of the five objects. This refutation is made by way of the Bhagwan's statement that consciousness is false and deceptive. The statement that it is deceptive refutes its being non-deceptive, and this in turn refutes its validity, because that which is non-deceptive is the definition of non-valid cognition. So it will come later. In what sense is it deceptive? As Chandrakirti puts it, it exists in one way but appears in another. This means that the five objects, form, sounds, and so forth, are not established by way of their intrinsic character, but appear to the sensory consciousness as though they were. Therefore, those sensory consciousnesses are not valid with regard to the intrinsic character of their objects. In brief, what Chandrakirti intended in this passage is that sensory consciousness are not valid with regard to intrinsic character of the five objects, but because they are deceived in relation to the appearance of intrinsic character in the five objects. This is because those five objects are empty of intrinsic character, yet appear to have it. For example, it is like a consciousness that perceives two moons. Page 166, for Chandrakirti's commentary on the 400 verses says, it is not reasonable that worldly perception should cancel perception of reality, because worldly perception is valid only for the world, and because the objects it observes have a false and deceptive quality. Therefore, since Chandrakirti is refuting the logician's position that sensory consciousnesses are valid regarding the intrinsic character of objects, he needs not refute the position that they are simply valid cognitions. Consequently, Chandrakirti is not giving a general refutation of the position. So right from the beginning of the clear words, when there's refutation of the four ways alternatives of production, then he asked the question whether this is being asserted from the point of view of valid cognition or not.
So in Prasangika Madhyamaka tradition, there are four valid cognitions. Well, the sensory cognition, then there is the mental valid cognition, and then the conventional valid cognition. So the same text, the clear word says, those are established through mutual dependence. When valid cognition exists, then there are things that are the objects of comprehension. When there are things that are the objects of comprehension, then there are valid cognitions. However, neither valid cognitions nor objects of comprehension exist essentially. Therefore, if a sensory consciousness is unimpaired, that is, no eye disease or other internal or external cause of error is affecting it, then it is accurate in conventional terms. It is mistaken in terms of appearance, because under the influence of ignorance, it apprehends its object as though it were intrinsically existent, which it is not. Yet this does not contradict its conventional accuracy. And commentary on Middle Way says, also perceivers of falsities are two types, those with clear sensory faculties and those with unimpaired sensory faculties. A consciousness with an impaired sensory faculty is considered wrong in relation to consciousness with a good sensory faculty. Those objects known by the world and apprehended by six unimpaired sensory faculties are true for the world. Thus, the rest are posited as unreal for the world. Thus, conventional consciousness and their objects are of two types, accurate in relation to conventional consciousness and accurate in relation to inaccurate in relation to conventional consciousness. With regard to the internal conditions that impair the sensory faculties, Chandragiri's explanation of the Middle Way commentaries says, eye disease, jaundice, and so forth, as well as eating dhatura and so forth, are internal conditions that impair the sensory faculties. With regard to the external conditions that impair the sensory faculties, the same text says external conditions that impair the sensory faculties include sesame oil, water, mirror sounds spoken from within the caves and such, as well as sunlight at certain times and places. Even in the absence of internal conditions that impair the sensory faculties, these cause the apprehension of reflections, echoes, this water of mirage, and so forth. You should understand that this is also the case with the medicine mantra and such used by conjurers and so forth. So with regard to the qualm and the response, why in conventional terms they are mistaken with regard to forms. So whatever things exist, the realists say that there should be something from within the object designated to be an entity or identity of that. So that is being rejected. On this point, the Master Pavavika asserts that it is the nature of forms and such to exist conventionally by way of their intrinsic character. The Chittamatrans argue that imaginary constructs lack characteristic nature because it is not their nature to exist by way of intrinsic character. To refute them, Bhavivika investigates the agents and objects involved in the process of imaginary construction. So he says that if they assert the terms and minds that construct entities and features lack intrinsic character, conventionally, then they are inappropriately denying the existence of contingent entities. Therefore, it is clear that Bhavaviveka asserts that contingent entities have intrinsic character conventionally. Along the same line, Bhavaviveka's lamp for Nagarjuna's Fundamental Treatise comments on the 25th chapter of Nagarjuna's text as follows. If you say that the very nature of a construct, the mental and verbal expression form, does not exist, then you are mistakenly denying things. For
Now, for you are mistakenly denying mental and verbal expressions. And then explanatory commentary on Bhavivika's lamp for the fundamental treatise on this. This statement by Bhavivika's indicates the following. The Chittamatrins, what is mentioned as Chittamatrins' position, is has to be thought through. Yogacharya say that it has no nature in as much as it has no characteristic nature. In the true eloquence, essence of true eloquence, it says, while dealing with the self-defining characteristics, there is, he makes a difference in subtlety between the Madhyamakas and the logicians. Hence, the Master Kamala Shila also asserts 170 that objects have intrinsic existence conventionally, intrinsic character conventionally. Chandrakirti's explanation of the Middle Way commentary says, for example, a snake is an imaginary construct when conceived in relation to a rope, but is perfectly real when conceived in relation to an actual snake. Similarly, our nature is an imaginary construct when conceived with regard to contingent entities, which are dependently arisen fabrications. However, as the object of a Buddha, it is considered perfectly real. Understand the presentation of the three natures in this way, and then explain what the sutra unraveling the intention means. He states this as a commentary on these lines from his commentary on the Middle Way. Any sutra that explains something that is not reality and sets forth the provisional should be understood as such and interpreted. Thus, it is obvious that he considers the sutra unraveling the intention as presentation of the three natures to be provisional. In his own system, imaginary refers to the intrinsic existence of the contingent. Hence, Chandrakirti does not assert that contingent entities have intrinsic character or intrinsic nature, even conventionally. The Chittamatrins accept the non-existence of characteristic nature only for imaginaries, but do not assert that with regard to the contingent and the perfectly real. Thus, they assert that these two have essential. As an answer to the latter position, the page 771, he's making a comment around that. Are you claiming that the aggregation of minute particles of one type on one place is not the cause of sensory consciousness, giving as your reason? Because such aggregations, which means the aggregation of minute particles, do not substantially exist. If you are, then I simply do not accept your reason. Why? It is as follows. Various minute particles of a single type coalesce and contribute to that aggregation, thus constituting the parts of an object. From this, there arises a mind to which an image appears. The image of an aggregation of minute particles, we hold that like minute particles, spots and such are also substantially existent, for they are composites of minute particles of a single type. It is the nature of the minute particles to be an aggregation of eight substances, yet you explicitly assert that it is substantially existent. And so with regards to the indivisibility of things or partless partlessness. There may be different interpretations. This is coming from His Holiness. Likewise, there are four parts and such, which have natures of being aggregation, are also substantially existent, and non-aggregation singularity does not exist. Thus, it appears that he asserts that each of the minute particles of a composite is at the cause of sensory consciousness and is substantially existent, since he evidently asserts that each of these is illuminated. Ultimate of the minute particles, he implicitly accepts that partless particles are the perceptual condition for the arising of a sensory consciousness. Therefore, Bhavaviveka asserts that sensory consciousnesses are not mistaken if they are affected by either the internal or the external causes of error explained earlier.
Krishna Bhandit in 71. The last paragraph, Chandrakriti's explanation of the Middle Way commentary says, some say that Madhyamikas accept in conventional terms exactly what the Sautantrikas advocate ultimately. You should understand that those who say this speak out of sheer ignorance of the reality explained in Nagarjuna's funeral. Even though all the sensory perceptions are not correct in terms of appearing all the objects as its own existence, but they cognize the object, so in this way they can be regarded to as being valid cognition. Also, there are those who think that the Madhyamikas accept in conventional terms that the Vipassikas advocate ultimately. Those who think that understanding nothing at all of the reality set forth in the fundamental treatise, page number 172. For supramental teachings cannot be likened to worldly teachings in this manner. The learned should know that our system is unique. Thus, it does not accept even conventionally the partless subjects and objects that are preceded by distinctive tenets of these schools. Chandrakriti's commentary on the 400 stanzas says, it is not right for Buddhist schools to assert substantially existent minute particles as to the Vaisheshikas. Thus, he says that he does not assert partless particles. Chandrakriti is referring to things such as partless particles. When he says that Madhyamikas do not assert in conventional terms what the two school, Vaibhashika and Sautantrika assert ultimately, he does not mean that Madhyamikas reject even conventionally everything those two assert is true, for while Vaibhashikas and Sautantrikas assert that things like forms and sounds are true, Madhyamikas do accept the mere existence of this conventionality. In the commentary on the 400 stanzas, Chandrakriti refutes the assertion that each minute particle within the collection of minute particles in the sensory faculty is a cause of a sensory. Faculties are not established either as being just those minute particles or being something other than them. Thus, the basis of sensory consciousnesses are sensory faculties that are ascribed in dependence upon those minute particles. Likewise, in the case of objects, he says that the objects of sensory consciousness exist as constructs that are contingently constructed. He also asserts that the consciousness is designated as direct, but the object of consciousness is actually what is direct. Therefore, although the Master Chandrakriti and the Master Bhavaviveka are alike in accepting external objects, they seem to differ in how they posit the sensory faculties and their objects. Earlier, while refuting that the sensory consciousness are valid with regard to intrinsic character, Chandrakura this commentary. Commentary on the 400 standard said that the object of a sensory consciousness is deceptive because it exists in one way but appears in another. Thus, things like forms and sounds appear to sensory consciousnesses as though they existed by way of their own intrinsic character, but the intrinsic character that appears to them does not exist even conventionally. Therefore, Chandrakriti asserts that those sensory consciousnesses are mistaken even conventionally. Still, it is not impossible for sensory consciousnesses to be valid cognitions that posit objects such as forms, sounds, and so forth conventionally. The reason why those sensory consciousnesses are posited as mistaken is that there is no object that exists by way of intrinsic character such as appears to them. The non-existing of such an object is established by a reasoning consciousness analyzing whether things exist intrinsically. It is not at all established by conventional valid cognitions. Therefore, in terms of conventionally consciousness, they are not mistaken. Then, when we speak about conventional truth, what do we mean by the truth? It means the truth in the eye of the ignorant. In reality, it may not be truth like an emptiness, but in the eyes of the ignorance, it may be truth. It appears a truth. As for consciousnesses that perceive things such as a double moon or a reflection, objects such as those which appear to them, two moons, a reflected face, and the light do not exist. This is established by conventionally valid cognition itself without relying on a reasoning consciousness. Thus, it is appropriate that these wrong sensory consciousnesses and the five valid sensory consciousness be differentiated as incorrect conventionally consciousness and correct conventionally consciousnesses. We allow that it makes a difference whether our consciousness is known as mistaken independence about reasoning consciousness or conventionally valid cognition. However, just as the referent of a perception of a reflected image as a face does not exist, so also the referent of a perception of anything as having intrinsic character does not exist. Just as forms and such which are empty of intrinsic character do exist, so also a reflection that is empty of being a face exists. For this reason, one cannot differentiate those perceptions in terms of their accuracy, even in relation to ordinary conventional awareness. Indeed, something that exists by way of its intrinsic character and an object and a reflection that exists in accordance with its appearance as a face are alike in non-existing conventionally. Also, forms and reflections are alike in existing conventionally, however. Chandrakriti's explanation of the middle way commentary says some dependently arise things, arisen things, such as reflections and echoes, are false and appear to be false even to ignorant. Some things, blue and other forms, as well as mind, feelings, etc., appear to be true. The final nature of things does not appear in any way to those who are ignorant. Therefore, the nature and whatever is false even conventionally are not conventionally truths. He thus makes a distinction that blue and so forth are posited as conventional truths, while reflections in such are not. If someone were to challenge this distinction, how could we reply? This is what I think. Although forms and reflections are alike. So this is very important. On the page 175, the statement, whatever is false, even conventionally, page number 178, sorry. How does one determine whether something exists conventionally? We hold that something exists conventionally if it is known. And when we refer to a phenomena existing by designation or by title, then of course actually we are not referring to its nature or the reality, because in terms of reality there are no phenomena that exist by itself. We hold that something exists conventionally if it is known to a conventionally consciousness, if no other conventionally valid cognition contradicts its being as. And when we refer to something as beautiful or ugly, and when we refer to something as ugly or good or bad, so these are all in the conventionally reference. If reason that accurately analyzes reality, that is, analyzes whether something intrinsically exists, does not contradict it. We hold that what failed to meet those criteria does not exist. In a sense, conventional consciousness operates in a non-acquisitive manner. It operates only within the context of how a given phenomena appears to it without analyzing. Is this how the object actually exists, or does it just appear this way to my mind? It is called non-analytical consciousness, but it is not the case. It is certainly non-inquisitive. It operates within the context of how things appear, how they are known to a worldly or conventional consciousnesses. It does not operate by analysis of how things actually exist. Therefore, it is called mundane knowledge. This kind of consciousness occurs in all persons, whether or not they have become involved in philosophical tenet systems. Thus, no matter whose mind stream it occurs in, it is called mundane knowledge or non-analytical consciousnesses. Do not suppose that it exists only in the mind streams of those worldly persons who are not involved in philosophical tenet systems. Those who are involved in such systems may often have minds that analyze in conventionally knowledge accurate, or does this object exist this way in reality? Since how could all of their consciousnesses analyze how things actually exist? Therefore, if you want to understand what worldly knowledge is, you cannot ask only those worldly elders who hold no philosophical tenets. However, it is sufficient to consider how non-analytical minds operate in the mind streams of the two parties in a debate. What this consciousness knows is a perceptual or experiential basis for the construction of conventional language. Ordinary people do not understand karma and its effects, the levels and the paths or such matters, but they hear about and experience them, thereby taking them as objects. As this is so, they appear even to ordinary consciousnesses that are not analyzing how things actually exist. We thus avoid the fallacy that these would not be things that the world knows. Other conventionally valid cognitions do not contradict that which exists conventionally. For example, a consciousness that does not analyze how things actually exist may think that a rope is a snake or that a marriage is water. However, a conventionally valid cognition does contradict the objects apprehended by such consciousnesses, so those objects do not exist even conventionally. A reasoning consciousness that accurately analyzes whether something intrinsically exists does not contradict that which exists conventionally. What is posited conventionally must be established by conventional valid cognition. In addition, reasoning consciousnesses that accurately analyze whether it intrinsically exists definitely must not contradict it in any way. Whatever such reasoning establishes as existing must exist essentially, so it is contradictory for such to be a conventional object. Because of that, it is wrong to confuse not being contradicted by a reasoning consciousness and being established by a reasoning consciousness. Such confusion is the basis for a misconception that the following two propositions stand equally, either both true or false. On page number 180, this misconception is incorrect. The two propositions are equivalent to the extent that a line of reasoning that accurately analyzes whether things intrinsically exist will establish neither. But the two are not alike in all respects. One is contradicted by reason and other is not. A partless object and a subject, a self, a primal essence, a divine creator, such things are imaginary constructs put forward in the unique assertions of Buddhist and non-Buddhist essentialistic. When they posit such, they do so after a rational analysis of whether such things essentially exist. They think that this sort of rational analysis will discover these things. Thus, because they assert that these things can withstand rational analysis, they have to accept that others outside of their school can perform such rational analysis in order to discover whether these things intrinsically exist. When analyzed in this way, such things cannot withstand the pressure of inquiry by impeachable reasonings. Thus, when reason does not find them, they stand refuted, for it did exist. Such reasoning will have to find them. We posit forms, sound, and such only as they are known to conventional consciousnesses that are not impaired by internal or external causes of error. We do not assert them as part of a system in which an analysis of whether they are mere conventions or instead have objective existence will find that they are essentially or intrinsically existent. Thus, rational analysis of whether they intrinsically exist is irrelevant because we do not assert that those objects can withstand rational analysis. For example, if someone claims So I thought I will stop here, but I will read till the outline completes. There are things that have been known to the world from beginningless time and yet do not exist even conventionally, in as much as reason contradicts them. As example, one can cite the essence that ignorance superimposes on things that essentially exist. Exist in eye and mind conceived by a refined view of the perishing aggregates or the object of conception that yesterday's mountain is today's mountain. Therefore, it is not the case that mathematics conventionally accept everything that is known to the world. By Bishop 182, final paragraph. Therefore, the truth of form, sounds, and such is posited in the perspective of ignorance. But ignorance does not posit things such as forms and sounds. For example, from the perspective of wrong consciousness, that appearance of robe is a snake, the robe is a snake. But this wrong consciousness does not posit the robe. Since the minds that posit things like form and sound are six unimpaired consciousnesses associated with the eye, etc., the objects that are established to exist conventionally and thus reason does not refute them. However, even conventionally, they do not exist as ignorance apprehends them. This is because ignorance superimposes an essential or intrinsic nature on things, and this intrinsic nature does not exist even conventionally. Therefore, reason conventionally refutes what ignorance apprehends. If it did not, then you could not prove that at the conventional level, things are like illusions. Ignorance superimposes an intrinsic nature on things. From this, the attachment, hostility, and so forth arise. Therefore, they do not walk about from ignorance. So here, the ignorance or the afflictions when we refer to, I think they are the subtle form of ignorance. The ignorance with the confirm or correct focal objects. Therefore, they do not walk apart from ignorance, but they depend upon ignorance. This is because ignorance is the main affliction. These are the innate afflictions that have operated from beginningless time. However, because reason can irritate the way that they apprehend things, their referent objects do not exist even conventionally. Therefore, objects of innate minds are of two types, those that reason can refute and those that reason cannot refute. The objects of the innate conventional valid cognitions that posit things like form and sound do exist conventionally. Hence, reason does not refute them. I'm afraid I may have said more than enough about this. I will not elaborate any further. So we'll end here. The mandala offering. Amen.